There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you. This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. It's never an easy call with so many problems in the world to know where to direct the money that you donate when you want to help out in this world. But what I can tell you is that when you donate to CAMH, you're saving lives. We know about the opioid crisis. We know about the mental health crisis. They are doing the work. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at camh.ca/CanadaLand to help us treat addiction and build hope. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Hover.com, the domain company that we use for our domain and for our email. Go to Hover.com and use the offer code CanadaLand at checkout. You'll get 10% off. We are here at the Toronto Comic Arts Festival. This is a live recording at the Pilot. Welcome.
Unbelievable.
Sticks and stones may break my bones, but cartoons could destroy me. There is something about silly, simple, crude drawings that has the power to reduce the world's most powerful people into laughing stocks. Historically, cartoonists have been censored, sued, imprisoned, and even killed. Our panel today, I think, qualified for the first three. Not yet the latter, thankfully. At least, not yet. It'll be a bad panel. Please welcome Megumi Igarashi, better known as Rokuda Nashiko. Nashiko.
Konnichiwa.
Loosely translated, that pen name means good for nothing girl. Her comic book memoir, What is Obscenity? The Story of a Good for Nothing Artist and Her Pussy, was recently published by Koyama Press. Our next panelist used to have a respectable job at the National Post. Today he writes Jughead for Archie Comics and Howard the Duck for Marvel.
Very, very little difference, really.
Please welcome Andrew Coyne.
Hey.
Please welcome Chip Starsky, also known as Steve Murray.
Oh yeah, little applause when I'm not Andrew Coyne. That's amazing.
Finally, Ted Rall is an editorial and political cartoonist, an author, a journalist, a controversialist, and a frequent litigant. His syndicated cartoon runs in over 100 newspapers, and his most recent book is Bernie, a cartoon biography of Bernie Sanders. He is ranked number 15 in Fox News commentator Bernard Goldberg's book, The 100 People Who Are Screwing Up America. Please welcome Ted Rall.
Thank you.
This live taping of Canada Land is brought to you by Anthony Edward Perry, Andrew Brenders, Allison C., Michael Healy, Ben J., Paul Fisher, John Rudy, and Eric Hawke. Eric, are you here? Would you please come up and tell us why you decided to be awesome?
Because I like supporting independent content creators.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We hear a lot about the opioid crisis. We talk a lot about the mental health crisis. These are serious problems. These problems affect us all. They've affected my life and my community. They're not intractable problems. I don't know what's going to solve them on a policy level, but day to day, helping people, that's what CAMH does. They do it on the ground when people need help, and they do it through research. The team at CAMH gave our team a tour of their facilities, and we were really just blown away by the incredible, heroic work that they're doing every day. They treat everyone with dignity, and their research is seeking and finding real solutions for everyone around the world. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction, and build hope. Hey, this is Jesse, now speaking to you from our studio to tell you that this episode is also brought to you by Hover.com. And what Hover does, and what we've used them for before we had a relationship with them as our sponsor, is that they take care of your domain. Like if you need a domain, you go to Hover and you get a domain. If you want emails at that domain, then Hover will help you out. And that's what they do. They don't try to get you to do other things like a lot of their competitors who, when you go to try to do something or get technical help, you find yourself getting upsold into other packages and web hosting this and security that. Hover is just simple and straightforward and affordable, and they're a great Canadian company. We use them. So should you. Go to hover.com, use the offer code CanadaLand at checkout, and you will get 10% off of your first purchase. This episode is also brought to you by FreshBooks, another great local company, a Canadian company, and our first sponsor ever at Canada Land. FreshBooks.com is, of course, the small business accounting software that is designed for you, that is super intuitive to use, that is for the freelancer or the small business. Like Hover, FreshBooks is the tool that I use for my billing, for my expense. It's scalable because I used it when I was an independent freelancer, and now I've got a small company with a number of employees. Things have gotten a lot more complicated, and yet FreshBooks is absolutely up to the task, and I use them for everything. They save me a lot of time, and they get me paid quicker, and they can do the same for you. Try it out for free for 30 days. When you go to FreshBooks.com, there's a 30-day free trial, and when you do decide to become a customer, and once you do, you're not going to go back. This is what you're going to use from now on. Tell them who sent you. You'll be doing Canada Land a favor. Thank you, FreshBooks. Let's start. I'm going to ask everybody the same question to begin with, starting with you, Nashko. What is the worst thing that ever happened to you as a result of a cartoon that you drew?
So I guess the first thing, the worst thing that ever happened to me would be I was arrested and imprisoned twice. But without being arrested, I wouldn't have been invited to come to this festival or things like this. And I wouldn't be known as worldwide as I am now. So I guess that was the worst thing that happened, but the result was pretty good.
And you were convicted on an obscenity charge, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
あ、でも控訴、即日控訴しました。
She's appealing the verdict.
Okay. Chip, what's the worst thing that ever happened to you as a result of a cartoon you drew?
You know what? Not much. I should probably go. You know, I worked at National Post for about 13 years, and they were actually really supportive, like, despite the faults of the National Post. Whenever they get complaints and stuff from other politicians about things I do, like, they would brush them off and they would support me. But the one time I was kind of called into the editor's office was I was covering a film festival party at Wicked, the now defunct swingers club. People don't like to fuck anymore. I don't know what's going on. But so I went, and you know, I covered it, and like, you know, it was kind of a boring party. So I stripped down and I got into the hot tub, and I interviewed people from the hot tub, and it was a lot of fun. Scott Speedman brought me a drink, which is I felt really good about that. And so I dripped a cartoon the next day, and there was one panel in it where like I drew the owner and his wife grinding up against a car, which was like on the stage. It was like their DJ booth was a car. Very classy joint, I'm going to say. And so I got called into the office. He's like, all right, so here's the deal. This paper appears in schools as part of a program. And you drew people grinding. You said they were grinding, and you put those little lines. What are those lines called when you show somebody moving? Like, well, I guess they're grind lines in this case?
Hump lines.
Hump lines. And he was like...
That's a technical term.
And he was like, Murray, this time you've gone too far. And I was so happy to hear that, because it felt like it was like one of those like cop shows where he's like, McGillicuddy, you're a loose cannon. Turn in your badge. So he's basically like, you have to like not do anything for a couple of weeks and just kind of like... You know, do your regular funny little man shtick and nothing.
You got went in for a couple of weeks. You got put on ice.
Yeah, exactly. Well, not like ice. Like, I still did my regular stuff, but he was like, you know, we're going to keep an eye on you right now. It was a kind of a refreshing thing. And there was no real fallout from it, except for the sense of joy that I got, which was nice.
Ted?
I have so many answers to this question. We just don't have time. So I'm just going to go with the most recent really bad thing. I was the cartoonist at the LA Times from 2009 until last year. I did a cartoon about a jaywalking crackdown in the city of Los Angeles. And within 2 months, the Los Angeles Police Union leaked my old jaywalking arrest records to the LA Times, which then proceeded to fire me and then publish a piece in their paper saying that I had lied about my jaywalking arrest in 2009. And when I was able to prove using sophisticated audio enhancement technology that in fact it was the cops that had lied and it was not the, that it wasn't me, the paper then doubled down and published a longer piece. And I am now involved in a massive defamation lawsuit against the LA Times. It's war. They just literally filed a motion a week ago demanding that I give them $300,000 or my lawsuit cannot proceed so that I can guarantee that they will receive their legal fees in the event that I lose my lawsuit. And we literally figured out that they did some sort of public record search to find out the equity value in my house. So they fired me. They slandered me. They admit that they slandered me in their own motion, and now they want to throw me out into the street. But there are other stories that really do compare.
I drew people grinding.
Nashko, perhaps you can give us a bit more detail about what the obscenity charge was about. And I think that when we think about Japanese depictions of sex, we think about some of the most graphic and specific pornography, you know, that I've ever seen anyhow. But it's all digitized when you actually get to genitalia. And I think that your work directly kind of took that on. Maybe you could tell us why you were targeted.
So actually, I maybe don't know why I was arrested myself. I did the 3D data. I used the 3D technology to, you know, scan my manko. And the police are a bit like...
Can you tell us what that means?
Oh, sorry. Manko means it's the Japanese word for pussy, basically. it's a really forbidden word in Japanese, so she insists on using it to make that point. So the police are really kind of freaked out by new technology, so they, in order to kind of keep a lid on it, they'll like arrest people. And so before me, there was a guy who was arrested for 3D printing a pistol. And then after that, I guess they decided to go after obscenity.
What I found so interesting reading about your case is that there were charges about the drawings that you've taken molds of your vagina and you've made all kinds of cute artwork and you've made a vagina kayak. There we go. Welcome to Canada, by the way, in both miniature and life-size form. And then you've drawn a comic book memoir about all this, but what they ultimately, the charge that stuck was the distribution of 3D schematics of your pussy. It was the technological. Right. And I was interested to read in your work that they are so clueless about technology that the formal police report referred to the name of your website as Crowdfund. After you'd crowdfunded the actual construction of the vagina kayak. So, just an observation. I want to ask the panel about the power of cartoons themselves to tell nonfiction stories. Everybody here, I think, is a multidisciplinary communicator and artist, and yet the cartoons seem to be some of the most potent format for some of these messages. And when we're talking about telling a true story, why choose a medium that is so inherently subjective?
For myself, because of the working at the newspaper, they would often go to me for things that they couldn't photograph. So, like, we did a story, myself and a reporter went to a nudist colony and did a story there, and we're not going to bring a camera. I mean, I did bring a camera. I took pictures of the reporter a lot, but I ended up doing sketches, and we told the story in sketch form. And there are a lot of cases like that where photography, which is traditionally used to document the visual nature of a thing, just wasn't the best choice, and so cartooning kind of was the way in. The downside to that is the fact that a lot of people will look at the cartoon and go, well, that didn't happen. It's a cartoon. For it appearing in the paper, like, I always made sure, like, I documented everything perfectly in case somebody came back and said, like, oh, you're totally making all this up. And no, it did. It did. So, yeah, that's kind of the easiest way into some stories.
It's interesting because I remember reading somewhere that before photographs, drawings were how you would illustrate a true event in a newspaper. It was, and drawings were believed. And then when the photograph came, drawing suddenly became the medium for exaggeration, satire, and
which is crazy because photography can be manipulated. Photography, like, not even like digital manipulation, but in terms of like the cropping of a photograph can tell a totally different story as well. So people always take that as fact, and cartooning is not fact. Yeah. And that's really kind of mind-blowing to me.
What about you, Ted? Because you use cartoons for everything from like war correspondence to just sort of telling the story about getting harassed by cops. Why not just write that up? I mean, that seems to be, and you write as well professionally. So why choose to draw pictures where you're gonna, with every line, you can kind of convey a slant or a point of view?
Well, cops don't normally let you photograph them when they're handcuffing you for jaywalking. It's hard to hold the camera and get a good angle for the same reason. For example, when I went to Afghanistan to do war correspondency, there's a cultural and religious stricture against photography in among the Taliban and among many people in the Middle East and in South Asia and Central Asia. So I often found it easier to, draw people where I was not allowed to photograph them, or they would not give their consent. So that just for practical reasons. But probably the best example of this for me was my book To Afghanistan and Back, which was the first book about the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. It was really the answer to the question, you know, not what is the U.S. doing there or what does it mean politically, but what does it feel like? Americans just weren't getting a sense from TV coverage, you know, of like what it feels like, the temperatures, the grit, the dust, the fear, the visceral feeling. And I have an extremely primitive drawing style, very abstract. As Scott McCloud has written in his theories about comics, the more abstract your drawing style is, the more that the reader can put himself or herself into that place, less so than, for example, more detailed work like, say, Joe Sacco's, whose work I really much admire, but that's his experience, but it's hard to project yourself into his experience. I think with my style, it allowed people, you know, people came back and they were like, oh, I could feel the dust in my teeth. you know, in a way that, like, books that I later did about the same subject that included lots of photos, people did not come away with that same feeling.
Yeah. It's funny, I was going to say, at the National Post, we had a war artist, Richard Johnson, who, like, he was our graphics director, but he always, like, he was just doing that so he could get to Afghanistan, like get sent on tours so he could do kind of drawings of the soldiers and the environment and the people there. And his was a case where his stuff was really detailed, but it was always raw scans. Like, he would always do it like pencil, like, and you could actually feel like the people and the characters and the situations and his little, weird little annotations of things. And, you know, it's become like his life's mission, because it's like, it's the easiest way to convey the feeling of the situation. You're absolutely correct. Like, there's a tactile nature to it that's sometimes missing with photography, strangely enough. Just the feeling of a person observing and translating what they're observing to the reader that way.
It's sort of counterintuitive, you know, especially if you're not familiar with, like, Scott McCloud's ideas of, I guess, the semiotics of this, that our whole culture seems to suggest in visual communication, more is better. 4K is better than HD, and the more visual information, if you want to feel what it's like, you should see every particle of dust. And yet, what I think the trend for years now in nonfiction comics has been, Joe Sacco is sort of an outlier.
Right.
You know, the simpler and more pared down.
Like Guy Delisle and people like that.
Yeah. Like Spiegelman's Mouse, like all the stuff that kind of reduces it, you know, to like the most raw symbols. For some reason, that seems to put you into most kind of direct contact with the subject matter, and that's a hard idea for people to get their heads around. I mean, you want to reflect on that? Have you thought much about that?
Well, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It's just that it happens to be completely true. So it's just one of those things that if you observe it, and you just, you know, I've been doing this for most of my life, and you know, I do some work in a more realistic style and other works more abstract. The abstract stuff just works better for that exact purpose. You know, I mean, if think about like Peanuts, very simple drawings, right? And but you can, you know, you can get a sense of place and feeling, like you can feel like Charlie Brown, even though, of course, you know, he has hydrocephalitis or something. You know, his big circular head doesn't look like a human being at all. And what's that thing on his forehead? And you know, but somehow you can empathize with him. You know, superhero comics, which are hyper-realistically drawn, I have no visceral feeling whatsoever for those characters. I'm not ever going to be Bruce Wayne in any world, you know, for a lot of reasons, especially financially.
Yeah. Nashka, this is sort of something that is evoked when you discuss in your new book the power of cute, that you're talking about the taboo about graphic depictions, and you yourself are telling a story about really horrendous things that happened to you, being thrown in jail and being persecuted and being attacked in the media, but you draw it all in this delightful, cute style. What is the power of cute?
Cute or kawaii or warai?
So I think, like, with something like cute, or, you know, that idea of cuteness, you can, it's something you can laugh at, you know, you can fool around with cuteness. It's very, like, lighthearted. And, you know, to laugh at authority, like, I think what the authorities fear the most is being laughed at and being made fun of.
Mockery, I guess, is sort of at the heart of this, that drawing a caricature of somebody, reducing them to their essence or what you feel is their essence, seems to be, it cuts deeper than an editorial might, and it's it packs such a visceral, immediate punch. Talk to me a little bit about this weird place. It's so strange that in a newspaper so concerned about these formalities and absolute accuracy, there's this little special spot where you can draw somebody with, like, jagged teeth, biting babies, blood running down their chin. Like, you can make the most outrageous statement about somebody, and if you were to just sort of describe that in words, it would not be allowed in the newspaper.
Well, that used to be true. The United States has become really almost a cartoon-free zone. Many newspapers don't run them at all anymore. When I got into this in syndication in the early 90s, there were over 400 staff cartoonists and many hundreds of freelancers, probably close to about 1,000 politically oriented cartoonists in the U.S. That was already way down from about 2,000 at the turn of the century. Today, there's fewer in the U.S. than there are working in Iran. We're down to about 18 or 19 or 20. And I think we will see the end of political cartooning in the U.S. within the next 10 years. It's basically been targeted as something that needs to be abolished by newspapers. But, you know, it's a circulation driver. Readers like them. That's how they got into the paper in the first place. It was always like a free fire zone, and they're a holdover from a time when newspapers were brazenly political. In the U.S., there were newspapers with names like the Arkansas Democrat, because it was a Democratic Party-oriented newspaper. There were, you know, other papers were called the News Republican or whatever. The sort of simulacrum of objectivity that emerged in sort of the post-Vietnam era, where the press was supposed to be supposedly objectively truthful, started to like leach into the editorial pages, and people started saying, "Well, cartoons aren't fair." It's like, no, they fuck as hell aren't. And they're not supposed to be, because they're not any good when they are. So they're basically been kicked out of newspapers, and they're obviously online now. The problem in the U.S. isn't that there isn't good work being done. There is. It's online, and it's great. The problem is an economic model that would sustain, to pay someone enough money to be able to dedicate most of their week to thinking about current events and politics and then commenting on them, that we're struggling to figure out in a big way. There's, you know, fits and starts. The internet's just not doing it yet, but maybe someone's going to figure it out. But at this point, we're like, you know, buggy whip makers or whalebone corset makers. You know, we're on the way out.
It's tricky because newspapers in general, they kind of rely more on jack-of-all-trades people. Like, my experience at the Post was, you know, okay, I'll do cartoons, but I'll also do graphics, and I'll also design the paper, and also write a column. And, like, so the idea of, like, somebody that does one thing, there are only, like, three or four, like, you know, kind of major columnists that's just kind of their beat, but everyone else is kind of, like, you know, at the Post recently, like, I don't know, they lose a couple of reporters in a couple of sections instead of hiring two reporters. They hire a reporter that reports to both sections now. So it's like, okay, you're a financial reporter, you're also an arts reporter, and you're also a general reporter. So it's not even just like cartoonists, but it's like everyone is kind of like being tasked with doing multiple things, so you don't have specialists anymore.
Sure. Know? But your role at the Post was sort of an interesting illustration of that. Haha.
Good job.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, because, I mean, listening to Ted talk about what's happened to the editorial cartoon, I think that some context has to be provided, that some of the wounds are self-inflicted, and that political cartoons on the editorial page have been less and less cutting, and they've all sort of adhered to one rigid style. And I think that they've lost their influence, and you don't have that same kind of celebrity. I mean, some of the work that was done just from a cartoonist standpoint, the draftsmanship of the work 50 years ago is so much greater than what we see now. And then, Steve, you sort of created for yourself or evolved a role at the Post where you were not in that section. Your stuff didn't look like a traditional editorial cartoon, but you were doing satire about news events through like infographics, through diagrams, through different types of cartooning. And it seemed like for a second that like, oh yeah, there should be a guy who draws at a newspaper or a person who draws at a newspaper and makes fun of people. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in that black and white, you know, comment section page.
Well, I don't know how much it's changed since I left, but like during my time there, there was a rise of what they kept calling alternative forms of storytelling. Uh-huh. They were like, oh, just writing doesn't do the trick anymore. So they wanted new ways of telling the stories. And, you know, that's kind of reflected in the fact that every reporter has to shoot a video now as well. And so, yeah, I was able to kind of create that as a result of, like, they were scared of the internet and they wanted kind of new ways of showing things. And they also wanted to fill space in the paper because they had less content. And the easiest way to do that is to have somebody that does both things. I do the art and I do the writing, and it's scalable in the paper. So just from a logistics point of view, like, I could redesign a page of a paper at the last second when an ad came in to fit the space.
Right.
Like it's all, there's so many levels of so why they wanted these kind of forms of storytelling. And I think they still do want them. Like, you know, the Post still kind of contacts me and kind of asks me, you know, do you know somebody that can do this or somebody that can do that? But visually?
When you left, I don't think the Post filled that position, nor do I think that there's any other paper in Canada that has somebody who does something. those?
No. Because I don't think the higher-ups quite understood it as well. Like,
yeah.
I think, you know, it's not a matter of the editor-in-chief going, I need to hire that, and then they take the money and they put the money towards that. The editor-in-chief now has to go, I want to hire for that. I've got to go upstairs to these weird old white guys who don't understand why they would want to hire somebody who draws and does video and stuff like that. Like, what? Like, what, cartoons? Aren't those a thing like Ziggy and Garfield? Like, there's just such a disconnect. And
yeah.
It's hard.
Noshko, I am incredibly ignorant about satire and editorial cartooning in Japan. I know about manga and not much more. Is there a tradition of making fun of people with drawings in the media in Japan?
Is it okay if I say a little more about the cute thing that we were talking about before?
Please do.
すっぱたかに頑張るとしかしなくて変態みたいで、それを警察が堂々とキャラクターにしてるんですよ。
For our podcast listeners, Noshko is holding up a stuffed animal with a leather belt as she was making those points.
So I think, like, actually, cute things are really close to us. You know, they're something that we feel really familiar with. And so here we have this police character. The police made this really cute mascot character. And he's really, like, the thing, you know, that makes a real impact for me is that this character is, like, obscene, you know? This character is, like, a pervert. Look at him. Like, and this character is just, like, so out there. Like, they're just... The police are putting this character out there very, like, proudly. And I think it's really funny. So lately I always bring this Pipo-kun to my events. And I think that, like, cute has the power to make something scary, like a scary institution, into something that's not scary.
Chip, I want to talk about sort of this continuum of...
Oh, man. I don't have any props.
There seems to be, like, the scale between the most direct form of a cartoon where you, like, just draw somebody with stink lines coming up from their butt and say, this is you. And it's like, oh, damn, that's a diss. And
yeah.
And then abstracting it to something like this. Or, you know, and these are all tools at a cartoonist's disposal. You can either make it direct and, you know, risk a lawsuit or, you know, whatever else comes with really calling out the point that you're making. Or you could do something like the Glomps. In one of your recent comics, who are just obviously gamer gators and don't deny it.
I am not going to go on the record and say that because I don't want to be harassed, but So for anyone not familiar, I do a comic with Kagan McLeod called Kaptara, which takes place in a kind of a He-Man fantasy world. And I wanted it to be the kind of a place that was, like, free of racism and sexism and homophobia because the main character is gay and I want him to, like, kind of experience this world. But I was like, oh, all the bad stuff in that world has to go somewhere. So I created these, like, Smurf-like characters in the forest called Glomps. Just these dudes who were just, like, felt like they're being persecuted in society and retired to the forest.
And like the Smurfs, there's no women.
Yeah, there's no women. But they do drawings of sexy women for each other. which to me always seemed like a weird thing that, like, straight guys would do to get other straight guys off. And I'm like, well, that's not really straight. it's funny because I actually didn't really think Gamergate when I was doing it. I was just thinking of, like, all just kind of general shitty online trolls and
sure.
And dudes and stuff. But, like, as soon as it came out, people were like, oh, I see what you're doing here. And, like, I would actually get a lot of messages, like, about a bunch of different groups. Like, thinking, oh, you did this about these guys. Oh, you did this about these guys. I'm like, no, but it's fantastic that you think that. Like...
I don't believe you, but it's interesting.
No. Anyone and Gamergate people didn't contact me because they never see themselves as the villain. Like, anyone that, like, thinks that they're being attacked never sees themselves as the villain. And I kind of like that kind of satire where you kind of get in there and, like, the people in the know are like, oh, I see what you've done here. And the people that you're attacking don't notice because they're like, well, that's clearly not me with those stink lines coming out of my butt.
Sure. It's incredibly effective, but I think it's also kind of Canadian, if I can make kind of a Canada-US parallel. Where you can kind of send up a type of person in a very abstracted, absurdist, like, Kids in the Hall sketch.
Yeah.
But the American thing is for a stand-up comedian to stand there and say, I'm talking about Joe Smith, fuck him, this is what I think of him.
Yeah.
Which I think is what your traditional editorial cartoon is more of that direct shot.
Yeah, and I like this way better, like, just because it's more freeing and...
And cowardly and yet powerful at the same time.
Yeah, sure, cowardly and powerful. That's me. Good job. Wow.
Ted, you were going to say something?
Yeah, you know...
Fuck you, Jesse. So before you get into this, fuck you. I'm doing a fun little fantasy comic with these little characters, and they can represent anything, and you can call me a coward here if you want. But frankly, fuck you. How's that for cowardly? Fuck you.
And which
sorry, Ted, please answer whatever shitty question Jesse's got.
Which of your many pseudonyms delivered that insult, by the way?
It's all still me, Jesse. It's all still me.
I feel like Donald Trump at the WWE. I think, you know, there's also a sort of cowardice in just attacking an individual as opposed to, for example, his supporters. Like, you know, if I'm coming up with a cartoon, what's more dangerous? Calling out Donald Trump, he's kind of used to it, or calling out Donald Trump voters, who really are far more likely to come and punch me in the face at an appearance than Donald Trump.
A punch in the face from Trump would be nothing with those tiny hands.
Like a fleshy little... you're almost like... I'll try to construct another dichotomy here between the power of cute and what you do, which it seems like there's just no... You're not trying to be cute in the way that you draw.
No, I would be far wealthier and have more house to steal by the LA Times if I did. I grew up in the 80s and, the punk, I was really influenced by punk and new wave and that aesthetic. And so I always liked a really gritty reality, artistic reality and aesthetic that goes along with what I see as the ugliness of a collapsing country like the U.S. So, and also I lived in New York for many, many years. And so it's, you know, you just see piss and shit everywhere. And, you know, you draw what you see. And I just like the aesthetics of subways and stuff. I applied for a job at the Newark Star-Ledger, which was in Newark, New Jersey, which is like just pretty much the shittiest city in the U.S. And I was so disappointed not to get it because it's so shitty. I wanted to be surrounded and immersed with that. And I would have loved it. And till this day, it just bums me out. I think that there is a lot of people who just don't like that drawing. And I have to say, one of my big regrets is that I draw that way. It's my brand now, and I can't really change it. But I think, like, the cute approach is far more subversive. If you can draw in a really cute, appealing way that, you know, gets the crowds into the theater, and then you come out and you smack them in the face, that's more dangerous. A lot of people will look at my drawing and just be like, I don't like the way he draws, and they don't even give my work a chance.
Nashko, the conflict that you're currently embroiled in, it seems to be so much a generational conflict, not just with the taboos and the mores of Japan, but it seems like just in what we were talking about before and the misunderstanding of technology, you bring up this double standard where there's like a Shinto festival for the phallus, but you can't just show a vagina, even in a completely non-sexual context, it's forbidden. I wonder if we can't, you know, as we look at all these trends of the press declining around the world, of this generational conflict, which, though it's so far away, feels very familiar here, what role and what place do you think subversive drawings and cartoons are going to play? And is it going to be online? Where is this stuff going to play out? Online, I feel like there's much of a higher chance of you speaking to the choir. And these very public forums where everyone got together and read a newspaper and you could scandalize people or it felt like you had to respond because everyone's reading it as they disappear. Where do you see the dangerous cartoons appearing from now on?
You know someone has to translate all that, right?
Brevity is not my thing.
Yeah, I was wondering why this panel was scheduled to be 2 hours.
Most of that's just me asking questions.
Yeah.
Like in the 80s, there were a lot more comics that were like making fun of, you know, society at large. But then in the 90s, when we get into like the Koizumi administration, you see a lot of that going away. Like there used to be like comedy shows on TV that would, you know, poke fun at the government or, you know, society. But then the country started to get really serious with Koizumi. And so, like, laughing, like, things that we were laughing at, it started to feel like you weren't allowed to do that anymore. And even online, like, making fun of people or making fun of, you know, those kind of targets is not really acceptable. That's kind of where we are. You know, on TV, you can't really have that kind of comedy anymore. And then, you know, the major publishers and stuff really pull back from that sort of thing. So really, at this point, it's really a kind of an individual level that you have to get out there and make those kinds of comics.
I think there's the opportunity to have even more dangerous comics. Like, that's the thing. Like, like newspapers, for how dangerous the cartoons could be, still were restricted by the people that kind of ran the newspapers. But there aren't those restrictions now. I mean, there very well may come restrictions in the forms of, like, lawsuits and things like that. But, yeah, I don't know. I've got a weird kind of hopeful streak in terms of, like, kind of online storytelling, in terms of kind of, like, dangerous content.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be a space for subversive drawings and satire. And obviously, it's going to be online. I mean, the question is, you know, if outrageously insightful and interesting cartoon falls in the woods, does anybody give a shit? And I think the answer is no. You know, there's lots of really brilliant work being read by, you know, cool, hipstery, smart people, but it's not making that broad cultural impact. That's just because of the death of mass media and the splintering of everybody reading, you know, their own Twitter and Facebook feeds that, you know, where in which they follow people who share their exact political and cultural ideology. That's the real problem, I think. We're just not talking to each other as a society anymore. I mean, you know, I was talking to a friend recently about one of the differences between, like, Europe and the U.S. You know, in the U.S., we don't even agree on the same facts, like climate change exists. You know, we don't agree on that, as if you're a Democrat or Republican. You know, in Europe, everyone agrees that it exists. The only question is whether anything should be done about it, and if so, what? At least they can have a discussion. They can have a political debate. We can't even have politics because we can't even define terms.
Do you think, like, the viral video is sort of the new editorial cartoon? You see these things that, I guess it's debatable how much they break out of people's ideological bubbles. You see things that support your beliefs more than you see things that don't. And it's always surprising me to learn that, you know, that Trump supporters have their own funny videos. And yeah. There is that whole other world. And you know, the algorithm is just giving me what I want, I guess. But it also seems to play the same role as, like, let's laugh about current events. And it's usually through some short clip that's auto-playing on Facebook.
Sure, or memes, obviously. Same
yeah.
Thing. Yeah. Yeah, the level of self-curation in terms of media consumption is definitely kind of a dangerous thing. Like, one of the things that I kind of miss from the newspaper, even though, like, each newspaper obviously had their slant, like, you open up a newspaper and you're being presented with a bunch of things that you wouldn't necessarily seek out online. Like, even if I'm, you know, reading Ziggy or whatever, you know, I'm still exposing myself to Peanuts. but like...
It's a rich tapestry.
There's, yeah, exactly.
Well, there's serendipity.
Yeah.
That's your Canada Land Show. I hope you enjoyed it. You can email me always at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read them all and I respond when I can. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadalandshow.com. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand. That's where you can go to support us. This show is produced by Katie Jensen. Thank you very much to the Toronto Comic Arts Festival. Thank you to the staff here at the Pilot. Thank you to our panelists from around the world. And thank you to the live audience. If you like what we do, please support us.
Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures. And it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.